You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 174A by Rudolf Steiner, 12 lectures, translated by Christiana Bryan, and they're entitled Europe Between East and West in Cosmic and Human History. This is Lecture 3, given on the 23rd of March, 1915, in Munich. The first part of today's lecture will be dedicated to knowledge relating to actual experience, around which our society's karma has, of late, skirted. And the second part is intended to shine a spotlight on issues which contemporary events make particularly noteworthy. In the last two public lectures, I was obliged to lay particular emphasis on the way in which, in order to imagine spiritual worlds, it is essential gradually to become accustomed to a new language, a language differing from that which we use when describing what we know through our brain-bound sense perceptions and our reason, of worlds in which we live. To some extent, in support of our friends, I would like to link recent concrete experiences that have played out in our wider circles with events of which I could certainly have chosen other examples, but I choose these because I would say they relate most directly to recent experiences and can provide us with concepts about the relationship between the human soul and spiritual worlds. Ever and again I have stressed that when the soul crosses the threshold on its journey of realization into the spiritual world, among its first experiences is becoming one with what it perceives, learns, and undergoes. Here on the physical plane, we remain to some extent enclosed within our skin and separate from what we are observing. As soon as we enter and have anything to do with the spiritual world, we no longer feel enclosed in the way our skin confines us to our physical body. We feel our entire being to be dispersed, as if identifying with every being and event with which we have dealings. To illustrate this, I will turn to some positive incidents. An elderly member recently went through the gate of death. This person had for years lived with all their feelings, with their entire soul, in the imaginations one acquires when one absorbs, and absorbs with great soulfulness, what spiritual science can offer. It is because it is so important that it is so often reiterated, theoretically gathering what is conveyed as spiritual scientific imaginations, cannot be the be-all and end-all. It can be a point of departure, but is not everything. Such imaginations must take hold of our feelings and sentience. Even in a public lecture, I was able to explain how the sentient soul is presently more connected with the eternal core of the human being, while what manifests from the consciousness soul touches more predominantly upon what human beings experience of the physical world. That is why it is so important to feel what can be felt when taking in spiritual scientific knowledge, because such feeling has far greater power to take hold of our souls and to really put them in contact with spiritual worlds than mere thinking, than reasoned deduction. It was with their feelings that the person of whom I was speaking had lived so extensively within spiritual scientific imaginations. So I can relate that it appeared to me very soon after their death, before I had even been informed of their death on the physical plane, how this personality, while still within their ether body, was inwardly processing all the feeling and sentient forces they had garnered, what they had themselves become through living for so long within the stream of spiritual science. What I describe appeared to me unbidden while their ether body was still connected with their astral and I, capital. The person who had gone through the portal of death came and told me that they were now feeling what they had become through spiritual science, what they were feeling now that they were no longer confined within their physical body. And there resounded from the person beyond the portal of death the lines I will presently read out. You will notice in the first three lines that the deceased uses a word which one can hardly justifiably find in one who has laid aside their physical body, but that is not the point. The word that refers to a physical heart is meant symbolically. Here heart stands for the etheric organ of feeling. Here is a case of someone who has traversed the gate of death and whose strongest experience before dying as if summarizes the result of their life, as if to say to themselves, I am now in a situation where I can experience the nature of myself, how the nature of myself appears when I grasp it with an understanding of how, in my feeling cognizance, I have attained it through spiritual science. This is how that individuality, less than 2 hours departed, let resound the words, which I must say are positioned such, that I have done nothing to them other than record what this soul said from out of their self. Their own words served as a eulogy at the beginning and end of their cremation. I read them now, quote, into worldwide spaces will I bear my feeling heart, that it become warm in the fire of sacred power's workings. Into worldwide thoughts will I weave my own thinking, that it become clear in light of eternal life, evolving. Into grounds of acquiescent sensing will I plunge my soul, that it become strong for true goals of human striving. Towards God's peace do I quest, with life's struggles and cares, preparing myself for higher selfhood. Toward work-glad peace do I aspire, presaging cosmic existence in my own existence, do I long to fulfill my human dues. Anticipating, may I then live toward my star of destiny, which in spirit realm appoints my place. Close quote. Let us hear resounding what this self can sense of itself as a result of it having evolved feelings instilled by spiritual science. It is important to bear in mind that we are dealing here with a personality who in this physical life reached a ripe age, and that the potential exists in one reaching an advanced age to wish to characterize themselves, so that only after death that self can fully express itself in its own identity. Thus, to observe it, one needs do nothing other than give oneself up to, lose oneself in identifying with, that being, to enable it to express itself, of itself. It was different in another instance, when it was a case of a relatively early death. Present events prepare us for encountering cases such as this, when so often people of a tender age are dispatched through the gate of death. Here, in the case to which I refer, it was not the cause it so often is nowadays, but it was still an early death. When a death occurs early, one can say, had the person lived longer, their ether body would not have been set aside, but could have supplied their physical body with forces for decades longer. Someone who passes through the gateway of death ahead of the decades they could have lived bestows their unspent ether body on the spiritual elemental world. Today, countless such unspent ether bodies ascend into spiritual worlds. If in spiritual science we speak of having great hope for the age evolving out of the lap of present events, what comes into consideration is that those who now cross into the spiritual world will become witnesses to spiritual work and through their individualities will send forces into earthly life. Their ether bodies persist as something secondary yet special in that they remain unspent. Large numbers of such ether bodies represent a force which will work on into human beings, will again live in peace once it is attained, and will become collaborators in dissolving materialistic world outlooks through their spiritual view of the world. We can be fortified when we experience how people die at a young age if we can, to some extent, perceive what is happening. In the second case, to which the karma of our spiritual stream contributed, and at whose cremation I was again to speak after they had gone through the gate of death, the time between dying and cremation was between Wednesday and the following Monday. By then, this ether body had departed, and to my occult observation, in the night before speaking, I had to some extent lost sight of that ether body. It was no longer visible. This individual was already at large with their astral body and I. Here was an observing soul, faced with an astral and an I. Again the wish arose to speak a few eulogistic words at the beginning and end of the funeral that had something to do with the individual. The resulting words were expressed by that person. In that they were released from their physical and ether bodies, it was possible, in what I think were precise words, to accurately encapsulate the nature of their earthly existence. Once again, these words are not mine, but are as they should be when characterizing a person who has traversed the gate of death, received through force of inspiration. Words arose as inspiration in the observing soul when surrendered to the impression of the deceased. Quote, "You walked among us. The limber gentleness of your being spoke from the quiet strength of your eyes. Peace, soulful enlivener, flowed in the waves through which your gaze rested on objects and people, conveying your inner interweaving. And this essence ensouled your voice, which bore through your words hue more than the words themselves revealed, the veiled being evolving in your beautiful soul. Yet the devoted love of compassionate lives were wordlessly, wholly brought to light. This being who, out of noble, serene beauty, proclaimed with responsive inkling cosmic soul creation." Close quote. These words were spoken at the cremation, and the extraordinary transpired. It was at the very moment, which can only improperly be called a moment during awakening, when the heat of the incinerator actually took hold of the physical body of this person. So for a moment, the opportunity arose for this person, who had gone through the gate of death, to advance their consciousness, not during the funeral service, but just as the flames were consuming their body. Then oblivion resumed. Such moments of consciousness that suspend unconsciousness can take place until full consciousness is established sometime after death. This instance showed particularly clearly the workings of consciousness beyond the gate of death. Such consciousness experiences time in a form quite different from the way in which human beings experience it when living in their physical bodies. This is significantly demonstrated here. The perception of time by those no longer in possession of a physical body can only be compared with our perception of space. Here in physical existence, we can always look back. What we have seen persists. If within time something has taken place, we have to look back on its image in memory. It has to arise in our consciousness. Such is not the case in one no longer bearing a physical body. The disembodied soul looks backward as we look back in space. This is how the deceased gazed back at what was being spoken, much as we look back spatially. What was spoken now appeared to their soul. In just such concrete cases is the singularity of the spiritual world made manifest. Now, I just said that at the time the eulogy was to be spoken, I had to some extent lost sight of their ether body, but a second glance showed that it was precisely this ether body that was able to supply the inspiration imprinted in the words. Once I could again locate their ether body, I mean for my observation, I became aware of where this ether body was while I was speaking those words. It was during the night between Sunday and Monday. I said that I had lost it, but it was only later that I realized where it actually was. I was myself within it. It was a dissolving cloud. The I and astral body had already separated off. Because I was within the ether body, I could not perceive it, much like a cloud in which one finds oneself. Yet what was alive in it provided the inspirational potential to etherically imprint the words I was to read. Here you see the mysteries and intimate proximity of the human soul with spiritual worlds. I would not make so bold as to mention this were it an isolated case, but it was reconfirmed in a third instance. Once again, I was asked to say some words characterizing this third deceased individual who had lived in our circles. The death of this person was something particularly painful for our feelings on a physical level, because this individual had embodied our best hopes for spiritual scientific work. They had, during their time on Earth, absorbed much of what is currently defined as erudition, knew their way around, was at home in it, and had the firm intention to do what is needed in our movement, which is to settle into what is now defined as science, and so to transform it in their soul, that spiritual scientific insight could be reborn at a higher level. Not everyone is capable of doing this, but it is among the essential requisites of spiritual science. Concordances between science and spiritual science can often lead, in those unfamiliar with spiritual science, to the belief that it is necessary to press ahead with present science, and once fully saturated with it, use it for a lively ascent into spiritual science. One arrives at a certain point where the correspondences afforded by current science with spiritual science appear so convincing, are known to be solid by inner experience, that one cannot be further misled by the material culture of these times. Once this person had gone through the portal of death, the need to shape the beginning and end of the cremation eulogy in a particular way arose again, a distinct impetus to direct this individual toward the bridge that exists in our spiritual scientific movement between the physical plane and the spiritual world. It is particularly painful for our feelings here on the physical plane that this person was snatched away from us in their youth. However, it could not have awoken as much hope as it ought to have in the spiritual scientific stream in which we live, were we not certain that forces streaming into spiritual science come not only from those living in the physical plane, but that forces also issue from those who have gone through the portal of death and who have been equipped with spiritual science. So the need was obvious to accentuate to that soul, something great has been vouchsafed you, now that you have gone through the gate of death, even now to remain a true participant and co-creator. Whoever takes spiritual science seriously needs to reckon with the fact that those who are no longer on the physical plane are still to be considered real co-workers. So, words had to be molded for someone, for whose imprint I was in a certain sense not responsible. Words that arose from their essential impetus, as I will now read. You will see what effect such imprinted words have, words that sound as follows. Quote, as a providential hope to us, you bestrode the field, where on earth the spirit blooms through the power of soul being, seeking to reveal itself in researching. Beings whose love of truth knew of your longing since time immemorial, creating out of spirit light was your earnest life's aim, one you ceaselessly pursued. You tended your abounding talents for the sake of spirit knowledge's bright path, not misled by world contradictions, a true servant of truth, transmuting ahead in sure steps. You schooled your spiritual gifts, making them brave and tenacious, when from both sides of the pathway error thronged you, creating space in you for truth. To your own self revealing manifestations of pure light, to fashion sun-soul forces that shone mightily within you, was your life's care and its joy. Other cares and joys barely touched your soul, for knowledge seemed to you as light, bestowing on life its meaning, on life its true value seeming. As a providential hope to us you bestrode the field, where on earth the spirit blooms through the power of soul being, seeking to reveal itself in researching. As a loss that pains us deeply, do you now depart the field where the spirit's earthly seed in the lap of soul existence flourished, and your sense of the spheres ripened. Feel how we gaze lovingly aloft to heights that call you to another creating. Send to your forsaken friends your strength from spirit lands. Hear the pleas of our souls sent after you in faith. We need for our earthly work strong forces from spirit lands, for which we thank our departed friends. As a providential hope to us, as a loss that pains us deeply, let us hope that you, far yet near, unlost to us, will light our lives as a soul star in spirit realms. Close quote. It was some time after the following night that the personality in question seemed to resound toward me, not from out of his consciousness, but from his very essence, as if in answer, such that it could be felt as an answer to the words above, yet not as though speaking from a personality. His essential core spoke, quote, "My own self to me revealing, of pure light to fashion, that sun soul forces shine mightily within me, was my life's care and its joy. Other cares, other joys, barely touched my soul, for knowledge seemed as light to me, bestowing on life its meaning, on life its true value seeming." Close quote. Only then did I notice that it was a transformation of two verses, transposing the second person into the first person form. You can see from this example how something of a correlation set in between the soul who had tarried in physical life and the soul now having gone to the gate of death. I wish to draw particular attention to the fact that these things are transmitted in such a way that one cannot change anything in the wording. You also see that I was not then conscious as to why the two verses had changed character, something I only adduced from the answer from the departed soul beyond the gate of death on the following night. We need to become accustomed, as in this situation, not to harbor such feelings in relation to spiritual worlds as are felt in the immediacy of the physical world. Please be aware that upon such qualities does a rightly understood relationship with spiritual worlds depend. As a small example of this, I could mention the following, coming as it does from quite the opposite direction. When these difficult days began, the verses we used were given as if direct from spiritual worlds, like the words I use today when I try to lead souls toward those who are amid events out in the fields or who have already crossed through the gate of death. Quote, "Spirits ever watchful, guardians of your souls, may your wings bear the beseeching love of my soul to those earthly beings entrusted to your care, so that, united with your power, my prayers may radiate help to the souls whom they lovingly seek." Close quote. There it says in quotes, "spirits of your souls." In Berlin, I had to face someone objecting that this was grammatically incorrect and that one couldn't know in the second line to what those soaring wings referred, because if one says, quote, "spirits of your souls," close quote, one is addressing those who are living as humans, yet one is turning to spirits of those alive. A pedant could opine that one should say, quote, "spirits of their souls," close quote. We do indeed need to become familiar with the fact that in the spiritual world, grammar, as it quite obviously and logically pertains in the sense world, does not necessarily apply, and that yonder one requires greater mobility of soul. One addresses them, quote, "spirits of your souls," close quote, but in the second line, it is obvious that one is not addressing one or a number of human beings, but the sheltering, guarding spirits. Grammar is not the decisive factor here. We have to be clear that in higher worlds everything is far more flexible, that one doesn't need to direct attention away from the person when addressing their guardian or sheltering spirit. These are in far closer contact with, in quotes, "their," T-H-E-I-R, "person," than ever two people are down here. In the latter case, one has to use physical grammar, because between two such people, no such close bond needs to exist as between a guardian spirit and their human soul. Thus one could say, precisely by means of words that are so susceptible to earthbound grammar in the form given, something of the unique character of spiritual worlds is conveyed. Words emanating from spiritual worlds then become an educational template or device. Sometimes one only understands these things much later on, and such learning is not as easy as making flippant grammatical witticisms, which is no great art. We have to find our way into this sort of delicate stance toward the spiritual world. When describing the higher worlds, much depends on not reaching for crass expressions acquired here in the physical world, whereby something of its nature is lost. It is easy to find fault with subtle depictions of spiritual worlds. The realm of spirits then loses the distinctive form of its power. In crossing the threshold, we enter the realm of the spirits of movement. Style itself has to become more agile. Spirits of form are, for the world, spread out around us. Style has to befit the realm of the spirits of movement. The time will come when a way will be found into such questions, and we will not be able to maintain that what is applicable to the physical world can also adequately depict what in the spiritual world is mobile and immersive. By using concrete examples to which our society's karma has led us, I wanted to illustrate and clarify some aspects of the relationship between human beings and spiritual worlds. Rather than outlining abstractly, much can become clearer by transposing oneself into individual spiritual circumstances, and, crucially, a feeling can dawn in us that through our spiritual scientific movement, a lively interrelation between physical and higher worlds must gradually arise. After the many experiences we have had to undergo recently, one can say, our hopes can be bolstered because some aspects of our spiritual movement can only exist if we are certain that those who have gone through the portal of death can become our supportive co-workers. This admittedly requires that we grasp with all possible gravity and intensity the content and intentions of our spiritual science. In conclusion, I would like to reiterate what was examined in detail in the Vienna lecture cycle about life between death and rebirth, and which it is important to take into account. We could say, because we have to use words that serve physical life, that human beings are in a kind of unconscious sleep after death. Then they awaken, though this is not quite the right word, which sounds as though they arrive at some sort of consciousness. That is not the case. Once the person has laid aside their ether body, they do not lack consciousness, nor do they exist in sleep consciousness, but they have excessive consciousness. They have a kind of overflowing consciousness, rather akin to being overwhelmed by blinding light and being unable to see. Such is the inundating excess of consciousness after death. We are engulfed by infinitely potent consciousness, which first has to be damped down to the level we have acquired according to our evolution in the physical world. We have to orient ourselves in this excess of consciousness. What we call awakening, yonder, initially involves becoming accustomed to the far higher level of consciousness entered after death. It involves dulling, dampening consciousness to a bearable level. Another thing I must say is that with each observation, one is increasingly shown how, for particular states of existence, the experience of life in spiritual worlds is the very opposite of experiencing the physical world. The following is a case in point, which I'd like to mention. Between birth and death, it is usually the case, without higher knowledge, that nobody remembers back to their birth. This is not a matter for anyone's own recollection. If one were to listen to those who claim only to believe what their five senses tell them, one could object. Then neither should you believe that you were once a small child. You only believe this for two subsidiary reasons. because you see that other people begin their life like this, and you assume that you did too. This is a conclusion only reached by analogy. Alternatively, others have told you so. Through communication, not by observation, do we know that we embarked on life by being born. Nobody notices that this is just an assumption reached by analogy. One would need to reflect. I cannot know anything about my physical origin on the basis of my own observation. When looking back over life, we do not see as far back as our birth. It is different between death and rebirth. This can be shown precisely where an inner wish arises to send aloft words associated with and characterizing the individual who has gone through the gate of death. This impulse arises from a longing to serve the one who has gone through the portal of death, to aid them in as swift a way as possible, to receive what they need, namely an unencumbered view of the moment of their death. For as little in physical life as one is able to look back on the moment of one's birth, just as essential is it to view one's death between death and rebirth. Death is always accessible to retrospection, but it appears differently from the spiritual perspective. It may have had terrible aspects when seen from the physical, but from the other side it is the most glorious event one can behold. Death is shown in all its splendor as it wrests spirit victoriously from physicality. This is among the most wondrously beautiful experiences seen in retrospect between death and birth. Here is a further example of the antithesis between physical and spiritual worlds. One gradually learns to recognize the idiosyncrasies of the spiritual world. These are perspectives I wanted to develop aphoristically for you today. A further viewpoint immediately becomes relevant to what we are experiencing at the moment. The view that alongside the person who under normal circumstances might have lived much longer, an unspent ether body exists as an individual entity with the deceased individual. Only in older people is the dissolution of the ether body of short duration. We are always surrounded by as yet undissolved ether bodies. We are living toward times when this will be very noticeable, because emanating directly from these ether bodies will an atmosphere be formed such as has hitherto never existed in Earth evolution. One might imagine this to have been similar in earlier wars, but things change, because in past times human beings went through death differently. Previously, there were not as many people living enveloped in materialistic modes of thinking. This causes ether bodies to dispense spiritual impulses. Further, human beings will exist on earth who know this in their feeling and feel this in their knowing. I hinted at this in lectures dedicated, as I say, to the events of our time. What our time wishes to teach us is that alongside spiritual leveling, we will also need spiritual deepening in relation to symptoms accompanying what will appear in future. Should we not experience as enormously distressing that our times, declaring themselves as they do to being so logical and enlightened, with scientific culture spreading into every quarter through popular channels, that in those same wide circles, something which we must regard as judgments based on passions, can grab such wide attention? Anyone heeding the voices which hold Central Europe to be as if enclosed within a vast fortress will soon realize what this passion wreaks in people's souls. You only need to look north and northwestward to see aghast how human passions and discrimination can bring us to such a pass. Better newspapers can be especially instructive. How one quarter or another will yell, "We didn't want this war. How could those who stand in opposition to the being of Germany, to the region which had the very least cause to want this war, Central Europe, quite so senselessly apportion blame for this war?" In this respect, it is objectively possible, due to the very ways and means in which the being of Germany has evolved, to acquire a certain national self-knowledge in a way that is sadly lacking in other peoples. It will certainly be possible, a long time after these bellicose, martial events, for the majority, that is outside Central Europe, to achieve sufficient overview of events, in some degree to leave behind the most idiotic opinions of the present. To us who live within a spiritual movement, not wishing merely to pontificate theoretically, to us it should be clear that in face of such difficult events an objective position can indeed be reached, one we can ourselves elucidate precisely because we are living through these destiny-laden days. How easy it is for some short-sighted wit to criticize what belongs to the core impulses of our spiritual science. In the past months, much has had to be painfully suffered in this respect. Here we have a spiritual scientific movement that says it is working lovingly to commit to humanity without differentiating as to race or any other such thing. One might reflect, how can what has lately been put forward by me not be in agreement with that? Before these fateful days broke over us, I warned against construing the principles of equality, equal rights, and equal status by inverting them into complete abstractions. Remember how often I said, when people come along saying that Buddhists, Muslims, or Christians are just varied forms of worshipping one being, it is like saying that salt, sugar, and pepper are all flavorings, so it doesn't matter which of them they use, while sprinkling sugar onto their soup and beer just because they are all food additives. Using generalities like these in abstraction can be comfortable, but any serious seeker cannot allow themselves to rely on them. If we immerse ourselves lovingly in the essential natures of individual European nations, we come to recognize that the folk soul of the Italians speaks to their sentient soul. Members of the French nation are approached through their intellectual soul. The British, via the consciousness soul. The German nation, through their I capital. It is not by abstractly pouring out love over every nation that one arrives at concepts. The essential nature of our movement will consist in recognizing that the human soul longs to rise to what is universally human, while and through acknowledging national singularities. Spiritual science can help someone born this time in Britain to muse, now I understand that the folk soul speaks to me primarily through the consciousness soul, through that which governs the relationship of the soul with the physical plane, through that which predisposes a person to be capable of being material. In acknowledging this, they can come to realize that they need to rid themselves of whatever hinders them, on the basis of their nationality, from rising to universal humanity. Such knowledge is always helpful, and the important thing is to acknowledge the idiosyncratic essence of each individual nation. If someone of Russian culture were to reflect, a unique feature of our folk soul is that it floats like a cloud above each individual, causing the individual to think chaotically when looking upward to their folk soul, and thereby to be dependent on finding their way into the productive element of other peoples. Were they to do this, they would find their way. Those who, through spiritual science, recognize the essential nature of the Russian folk soul will reflect, why am I a Russian? I possess the forces I have gained from it, so that I may absorb the strength of other nations. Through spiritual science, a German will recognize, and they need to conceive of this with all due objectivity and humility, that through the way in which their folk soul speaks to their I, they are predisposed, predestined, to seek what is universally human through their nationality. That they grasp that what leads them to transcend nationality is the national element within the being of Germany. Herein lies the concretely national element of German nature, that the national element is driven out above and beyond the nation into universal humanity. That is why the transition from German idealism to spiritual science is to be found in the confluence of German idealism with spiritual science. It is vital to struggle onward to concrete conceptions of spiritual realities. Spiritual science provides the opportunity to conceive of these matters concretely. When you hear that the Frenchman Renan says that what he has garnered from German culture seems to him like higher mathematics, when compared with what he absorbed from other peoples, which appears to him like a lower form of maths, this is an expression of what characterizes essential German nature. We are now destiny-bound to have to recognize this fact. We must recognize it, can do no other than acknowledge it. Yet we have to do so with the same objectivity, accepting that it is our destiny to forge ahead to truly spiritual life if we are properly German, in the same way as it is vital that the British slough off materialism in order to attain to spirituality. Differing tasks await the various nations on the basis of their national identities. It is particularly important for Germans to immerse themselves in the spiritual realm of all that flows through German culture. There is no such national imperative for Russians. For them, there is only the potential to accrue sanguinary forces, the forces of blood, that enable them to receive the essential being of other nations. It can be seen that the German core essence has learned much of importance during the evolution of folk souls. Folk souls, like human beings, undergo their own process of advancement. Between the years 1830 and 1850, something particular took place for the Italian folk soul. Previously, this culture was not as isolated from European culture as it later became. Before this time, their folk soul was working within the soul, whereas thereafter, it reaches outward beyond soul qualities and shapes the physical world toward national identity. While human beings stride onward to become independent of the physical world, the opposite is true of the folk soul. It works first at a soul level, then on the body, such that, before the 16th century, the Italian folk soul worked only on souls, later reaching out beyond souls alone into the corporeal, shaping the nervous system and the ether body so that the human being could determine, and then also identify with, corporeal embodiment. They became more brittle and rigid, increasingly shutting themselves off from other cultures. A similar juncture occurred for the French folk soul in the middle of the 17th century. The folk soul began to turn its sway away from the soul to encroach on the physical, causing the nation to become more rigid and unyielding. For the British, this only happened from the middle of the 17th century onward. Shakespeare does not yet belong to an age when the folk soul had transferred its hold onto the body, which is why Germans understand him better than do the British. During the time between 1750 and 1850, a certain transfer of influence from soul to body took place for the German folk soul, but it retreated from it once more. In Western people, the folk soul first floats higher, then sinks down into corporeality. Those which sank down into the physical earlier rose into spirituality again. Their descent took place between the middle of the 17th and 18th centuries. Due to this, the German folk soul remained more flexibly mobile. It doesn't constantly remain at the lower level, but alternates between high and low, taking hold of human beings and then leaving them free again. These are things which will only be fully understood in future. It must be said that we are not sufficiently capable of empathizing from the depths of our souls with these dark, difficult times, yet also with their great and significant potential. The events of these times ought to be endlessly significant for those interested in what is weaving spiritually throughout the world. Once people start to think about the root causes that have contributed to the present state of war, one thing will be clear. The antithetical tensions between folk souls will certainly have been a factor in present wartime events. But you will search in vain for causes in the physical world, never finding what clarifies the issue, because their origins do not lie on the physical plane, and because it can be said, spiritual individualities, spiritual impulses, are working into events. Only when this is understood by humanity will any sensible conversation about contributory forces be possible. It will then be accepted that human beings were mere tools, conduits for good and evil forces. To arrive at such a conclusion, a prejudice-free open-mindedness is essential. Suffusing ourselves with what spiritual science can be is not only for our reason, but for the innermost recesses of our souls. It can be important to recognize how much of what can be ascribed to the British is closely connected with national character. There will have to be acceptance of something that has been harrying me since July, since before the outbreak of war. Sundry opinions could be heard at the time. I am recounting objectively and wish to be assured that any personal element be disregarded by you. It was impressed upon me that the world was threatened with great danger because in London a terrible idiot, one Grey, was directing foreign affairs. The world considers Grey a clever, if perhaps devious, person. On the basis of intuitive impressions, I could never consider him anything other than an imbecile, and am still obliged to regard him as exceptionally stupid, as one whom, on account of his inability to reflect on situations, Aramonic forces could seek out for the purpose of effecting particular harm. Based on external criteria, it is hard to prove that such a person is a fool. Yesterday I bought a book in which was a letter written by a ministerial colleague of Grey. I only found out about the letter yesterday, but have since July thought Grey a fool sought out by Aramon to wreak calamity. It's interesting for us how the letter writer qualifies his cabinet colleague Grey, long quote. It is highly entertaining for us, who have known Grey since his inauguration, to observe how he impresses his continental colleagues. They seem to surmise something in him that simply isn't there. He is one of the foremost sports anglers in the kingdom, and a passably good tennis player. Yet he really possesses no appreciable political nor diplomatic aptitude. A certain tedious boredom in his manner of speech and a rare quality of inertia should be recognized as such. Earl Rosebery once said of him that he made such a concentrated impression because he never had a single thought of his own that could divert him from the task he had been handed, complete with precise instructions. When a temperamental foreign diplomat recently commented on Grey's taciturn manner, something that never revealed what was going on inside him, a cheeky secretary riposted, quote, "If you shake a China piggy bank that's chock full of gold, it won't rattle. Neither will it rattle if there isn't a single penny in it. Winston Churchill causes a few pennies worth to rattle so loudly that it gets on your nerves, but ne'er a clink from Grey. Only the person holding the piggy bank knows whether it's completely full or totally empty." Close quote. That was indeed impertinent, but well said. I believe Grey is basically decent, but seduced through a certain vanity to become involved in arrangements best left to those with spotless hands. His excuse is always that of himself he is unable to oversee and think anything through. Though he is in no way a schemer in his own right, once a canny schemer wants to make use of him, he can appear the perfect plotter. It has always represented a temptation for political strategists to choose him as an instrument, and he owes his present position solely to this circumstance. Close quote. Steiner again. This is an example of how one can be misled if there is no attempt to see things objectively. In this personality, who is not distinguished by any particular shrewdness, apart from his personal abilities in fishing, which have nothing to do with the crucial qualities upon which much depends, Ahrimanic powers necessarily had to rely on working from the inside outward, so that events actually came about. It will gradually be understood how essential it is to be clear about just such things, and how, in the supra-sensible, good and evil need to be recognized as such. Wanting to understand events on the basis of what can be observed in the physical will not result in insight. It will then be understood how various impulses streamed over from the East, how what gave impetus to these events had long been in preparation in the East, just as what can be observed in Eastern Europe at the moment, how factors evolved which of necessity had to light the torches of war, led to war because Western factors engaged with the arson coming from the East for reasons which can only be fathomed if one plumbs the crucial root causes. It will be important for these events to force people, if they want to understand root causes, to look up to spiritual worlds, and not to remain rooted in the physical, in which case they will be arguing for a very long time. We will have to see, more than will some others, that for anthroposophists it is vital to focus on a more secure horizon than that presented by experiencing the affairs of the physical world. Just how restricted the physical horizon can become has been noticeable for some time. For many, historical reflection only began in July. Even some within our circles subscribe to eccentric opinions. The elements of what I would like to say can be found in the lecture cycle titled The Mission of the Folk Souls, given in Christiania, Readers Aside, now known as Oslo, end of Readers Aside. There it is also described how in the East preparations are underway for what will emerge in the sixth post-Atlantean epoch. We are presently living through the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. If you think in the abstract that humanity is rising ever higher from the fifth into the sixth and seventh epochs, then you can get overwhelmed. But merely pressing ahead is not the way humanity's cultural evolution advances. Up to the fourth culture, there was a repetition of Earth's evolution. The fifth epoch is the decisive one. It represents something newly added, which must be carried over into the sixth era. The sixth culture will descend into decadence. It will be a degenerative culture. This has to be taken into account. Connected with this is a spirit such as Soloviev, who, with his habitual qualities, has in a certain respect outgrown Russian folk characteristics and immersed himself in the Western world, so that his philosophy is Western, albeit encased in the temperament of the East, but still in terms of sentence flow, recognizably Russian. It would be foolish to say that someone steeped in Western European culture could be endowed with something transcending that West European culture. Again, these are just by way of disjointed examples, but through them you will hear an appeal to try, through our spiritual scientific stream, to use these desperate times to understand and to clothe in concrete form all that really can flow into our feelings and sensitivities when spiritual imaginations flow into our perceptions. Our spiritual science will prove its worth in future precisely because it finds its way through the disturbingly troubled passions of our time. I am well aware that since the beginning of these oppressive times of ours, neither here nor anywhere else have I spoken of matters in any other way than could be presented to an objective worldview. And yet, what was to be heard? You can hear all sorts about what has been going on over the past few months, the state of various matters being criticized in the world at large. One is often obliged to hear the claim that the majority of members only listen to the opinion of a single person, that everything relies on blind faith. How far blind faith has got us is evident at this moment. Opinion was rife about what I have been saying. Quote, to while away his time, he uses his occult faculties to test Wolf's telegram. Close quote. exceptional trust from someone within our movement to say that I use the truth of Wolf's telegraphic bureau to the detriment of Germany's enemies. This is just one example among countless others. You see how the boundless passions overwhelming the world even play into spiritual science. This should not prevent us from seeking the truth in respect of what it is our obligation to pursue. You will understand this. Basically, it has always been as it is now. What has now been said has always been said and done. I have previously emphasized that this theosophical movement, which has now become the anthroposophical movement, has never wished to develop in any other way than within the onward progress of Central European culture. It has never been a matter of allowing anyone to tow us along in their wake. Seeing this, mistrust was spawned from the English quarter against these Central Europeans, who are not devotees of what was being presented by British theosophy. A sense of truth had to reject the British conception on the question of Christ, because it was such that a belief could have arisen that Christ would reincarnate into a physical body, the grounds being that a spiritual coming would be incomprehensible. This proved the impossibility of uniting the two directions. In English publications, you now find correspondence from Mrs. Besant, which in every way calls upon the theosophical world to act against those in Germany. There you have a belated explanation as to why the German theosophical movement had to separate from its English counterpart back then. Mrs. Besant says, quote, "Now, when I look back in light of German methods, as revealed by the war, I admit that the lengthy efforts to ensnare the theosophical organization and to set a German at its head, the anger against me as I frustrated these efforts, the complaint that I had spoken of the late King Edward VII as the protector of European peace instead of granting the Kaiser that honor, all this was part of a wide-ranging campaign against England, and that the missionaries were tools sent and used by German agents here," close quote, in India, continue quote, "to carry out their plans. Had they succeeded in turning the Theosophical Society in India, with its large numbers of government officials, into a weapon against the British government, educating them to look aloft to Germany as to their spiritual leader instead of insisting, as they had always done, on standing for the bond between equal free nations, it would gradually have become a channel for poison into India." Close quote. Steiner again. This personality has hit upon what I then wanted. So, there you see the root cause as to why war broke out between Germany and England. Yet you can see that our present struggle toward all that is spiritual has also progressed. Much of what had to happen then will perhaps now be understood differently. Affirming occultism is a double-edged sword. It has to be said over and over again that a sense for truth needs to permeate souls intensively, so that through it, salvation and not calamity is brought about in the world. How what has to penetrate into our souls as a result of the events of the present is connected with the way in which we, as keen students of the spiritual, can bear fruit is expressed in the following thought. When peace returns, there will be unused ether forces in the spiritual world, which will want to send down strengthening forces. And from souls enlivened by spiritual science, forces also need to rise up, uniting with those forces from above. Then will what is a blessing for the progress of humanity and what spiritual science is capable of becoming also become significant. If a really good many souls who experience this truly and objectively can be mustered, if very many souls can have thoughts illuminated by a spiritual scientific view of the world and can raise themselves in longing to spirit realms, then will all that is so hard about our times also be valuable for those souls. I would, therefore, like to bring the context of our spiritual striving to expression in these words, quote, from the courage of fighters, from the blood on fields of battle, from the grief of the bereft, from the sacrifice of people, there will grow fruit of spirit, if spirit conscious, souls will turn their thoughts to realms of spirit. Close quote. The end of Lecture 3.